All right, welcome to the Fifth Estate. My name is Jay Caruso. I'm here with my host, Mr. Neil Dewing. How are you?
Well, I'm a little bit under the weather, but I crawled out of bed just to be here, just to talk to you, Jay, and talk to our listeners.
Yeah, well, you know, you sound a lot better, which is good. So I'm happy happy to see that you're feeling better. As we say always to our listeners, if you guys like this show, please subscribe, tell your friends to subscribe, go out to iTunes, leave us a rating. We appreciate that. Okay.
You can also leave us some comments on the website or on our Facebook page. So reach out and touch us.
Absolutely. All right, we're pretty excited. We have a presidential candidate joining us on the show tonight. And as I would think, out of some of the candidates that are running, I would much rather speak to this one than some of the other ones. So we're very happy to welcome independent presidential candidate Evan McMullen to the show. Evan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
All right. Hey, let's start off before we get in. We're going to get into the campaign, and we've got some Facebook questions. Some people have asked about some things, and I think there's some interesting questions. But let's kind of explore your background. Let's kind of start with you.
Sure.
And tell us where you're born, where you're from, the whole kind of run that whole gamut first before we do anything else.
Sure. Yeah, I was born in Utah, then quickly moved to the Seattle area when my dad got a job at Boeing out of college. My parents met at Brigham Young University, so we moved up to the Seattle area. I went through all my studies there, elementary school, junior high, high school, eventually in junior high and high school, lived on a small farm outside the city, about 30 minutes outside of Seattle. So finished my schooling there, and then I did a Mormon mission in Brazil. And after that, went to college at Brigham Young University. And while I was there, I was hired by the Central Intelligence Agency. And so for the rest of my undergrad career, I would spend a semester in D.C. and then a semester back at BYU and going back and forth like that until I graduated. And then I did graduate and then went undercover with the Central Intelligence Agency immediately and went through some covert operations training. And while I was going through that process, 9/11 happened. And so when I finished, I was shipped off. I volunteered and then shipped off to serve the next several years in war zones and other hostile environments in South Asia, the Middle East, and North Africa. After I completed my service with the agency, I left and went to business school at Wharton in Philly and spent a couple of years there, and then started, while I was at Wharton, started working for Goldman Sachs. And then when I graduated, I went to Goldman Sachs in San Francisco, where I was an investment banker there, working with a range of industries on M&A and IPOs. And then while I was there, I was asked by Chairman Royce, who took over the Foreign Affairs Committee in the House of Representatives, to come be a senior advisor to the committee. I accepted that and did return to service then and did that for the better part of a couple of years. Then I was asked to come up and work with House leadership as the chief policy director for the House Republican Conference. And then towards the end of that period, just a few weeks ago, I decided that I would run for president. I'm sure we'll talk more about that. But in a nutshell, that's been my path.
Okay. What's interesting about your entire background, a lot of, a very varied, a varied background, business, government, the CIA, but, no elective office, which I'm not saying is a negative. I'm just saying it's an interesting path that you took, and working for the CIA as long as you did, especially covert operations. I mean, there's been some talk, and I just wanted to ask you about that, and not
sure.
Nothing specific, but we have heard over the last several years that, and you can correct me if this information is wrong, but we're having difficulty getting people who will actually go in and do that work. I mean, because basically, if you're doing that for X amount of years, you're pretty kind of, I would think you're kind of cut off from people, and you're, Where you have to live and everything that you have to do is just you're kind of living in an entirely different life for X amount of years. And is that true? I mean, is the CIA having trouble recruiting people to do that? I mean, we seem to have more assets on the ground before than we do now. I could be wrong.
Yeah, well, you know, those how many people they have and their recruiting numbers and all, it is all classified, and I don't know right now what they are, to be very honest. But I will say that when I was there and before I was there, they had no shortage of people applying for that job. I mean, it's a pretty incredible job that is unlike any others. You're able to serve the country, and it's obviously a lot of adventure and very challenging in a lot of ways. It's certainly always intellectually challenging. It can be physically challenging as well, depending on where you are and what you're doing. I mean, I would be surprised if they were having a hard time attracting people interested in doing the job. You know, then there's always a question of the quality and are they able to find what they're looking for? And I can't speak to what that is now, but certainly when I was there, you know, people were beating down the door, applying, you know, multiple times and really high quality people. So I'd be surprised if that's different now, but it could be.
Okay. Well, I imagine that after doing that kind of work, somebody like Donald Trump doesn't exactly get your heart rate up too much.
Yeah.
Probably seems a bit less intimidating than he might otherwise appear. Talk about your business background a little bit more. You mentioning Donald Trump, of course. You went to Wharton, which he is also an alumnus of Wharton, I think. Right, that's correct. And so
he is.
Which just goes to show you what wide variety of people go to Wharton because you seem entirely likable to me.
Well, thank you.
Which,
Wait till you get to know me. Just kidding.
Well, yeah. Tell us a little bit more about kind of your business, the business end of your career.
Yeah. Well, you both mentioned a lot about the agency. Maybe we can go back to. I learned a lot. I learned a lot at Wharton. Obviously, I left the agency never having spent any time in the private sector, and I really wanted to do that. And so I knew that I couldn't just go from the agency into business because I didn't know anything. And I knew how to be an operations officer with the Central Intelligence Agency, but that's a very esoteric skill set that didn't necessarily apply in finance or strategy, or marketing. So I knew I needed to go back and do some retooling. And so I did that through Wharton. I was fortunate to be admitted there, and it's a tough program for those who take the academic part of it seriously. And I learned a lot there. And then I wanted an experience after Wharton where I would learn a lot in a very fast period of time, and in order to sort of make up for the time I had spent serving the country overseas. And so I went to Goldman, where I knew I would work 3 hours or three weeks for every 1 week that a normal job would require. And so working really around the clock, I learned an awful lot about a range of industries and companies within industries and what it takes for them to succeed and compete in the global marketplace. That was at a time when there was a lot of, as there still is now, in my view, regulatory uncertainty and burdensome regulatory regime for many industries. And so seeing, CEOs and CFOs make strategic decisions to try to stay afloat or grow their businesses was very educational for me. And I walked away with really a wealth of knowledge in that area.
Well, that portends well for you get into office and you have that business experience, which a lot of people are always wondering about. Then you went on, you served in the CIA, then went work in the private sector, and then it was kind of back to government. And you became a pretty came pretty high ranking there in the House Republican Conference. So obviously you've got some politicking experience as well. So explain how what that was like. I mean, how, you know, what was that experience like?
Well, first of all, just say as an American, I mean, forget about, you know, my role and anything else. Now, I'm somebody who loves democracy. I love our democracy. I love that, you know, people are empowered in our system. I think there are some reforms that need to take place so that people are more empowered, actually. But still, we, you know, this is the greatest experiment of freedom and democracy the world has ever known. And I still remember the first day I walked onto the floor, onto the House floor where the members vote and, you know, and debate legislation and ideas. And I'll candidly admit I got emotional. I mean, it is a beautiful thing. We are so fortunate in this country to have the freedoms that we do. And, you know, we've got a lot of problems that need to be overcome, but this is still a wonderful place. And we are so lucky to be able to elect our own representatives to Congress and to have them do our bidding, even as difficult as times are in this divided country. But that was the first sort of impression, I guess I would say. And then secondly, I just felt very grateful for the opportunity I had to influence members of Congress and other people engaging in the political system in our country around areas of government reform and national security and a variety of other issues like our health care for our veterans and a range of other things. I mean, I felt very fortunate, still feel very fortunate to have had the opportunity.
Because that is what as the chief policy director, the House Republican Conference, that is what you did. You communicated the party's message, the party's platform and beliefs to those members of Congress. And did you work with the public at all, or just within the House?
No, we did also work with the public. You know, you learn when you're in that role, and really in any role in Congress, whether you're an elected member or a senior staffer like I was, or a junior staffer, you learn that you need whatever you want to do, you've got to have your political allies, or you, more specifically, support from the people of the United States. And so, you know, if you're thinking about doing X, Y, or Z, you've got to make sure, and you probably wouldn't be interested in doing it in the first place, unless you had support from people. And so you're engaging with those people. Sometimes they're represented by groups that are sort of organized around a particular cause, or you get to them in other ways. You may even, you know, bring them together yourself, use the power of convening that you have in your role to bring people together to hash out problems. But yeah, you're dealing with the people constantly, and that's the way it should be.
And it's been somewhat challenging over the past few years, I think, for Republican leadership to communicate their message and make sure that that people are following and following their attempt to lead. Did you run into difficulties in that realm?
You know, I do think that in general, I mean, I say that I consider myself an American first, a conservative second, and then I think about party. I do feel that conservatives in general could be better about communicating the value of principles that I think are universal and enshrined in our Constitution that really transcend partisan politics. I'm talking about equality and personal liberty and our right to pursue happiness. These are things that, you know, the conservatives care a lot about, but I think all Americans care about these things. So there are some leaders, I think, who are very good at communicating these ideas, but others, you know, maybe can improve. But in general, I think conservatives could be a lot better about communicating the value of these ideals to the American people.
Well, let's take a step back. I just want to go back to your service in the CIA because, you know, there was following the 9/11 attacks and some of the things that happened. There was, you know, it was almost kind of like the the church hearings in the 70s when the CIA was under this kind of like brutal, you know, this attack largely from the left about, you know, some of the things that they had done. But, you know, I think, again, without divulging anything, you know, I don't think people understand what it is that you guys were doing, the kind of work, the stuff that we don't know about. I would imagine that if Neil and I got a look at it, what you guys were doing on a daily basis, we probably, like, you know, wet ourselves or something, because it's it's the kind of thing that most people just – all they do is they see something from afar and they're ready to cast aspersions, but they're not in – you know, they're not there doing the dirty work every day. Why don't you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, well, I think, look, you're putting your finger on something that is just, you know, a classic problem for intelligence services. And, you know, I have something to say about that. But, you know, this is the thing. Intelligence work, by virtue of what it is, has to happen secretly in almost all cases. I mean, it just has to happen that way so that it can be protected, so that it can be successful, and so that those who are involved in it can survive, basically, and be successful in their mission. So because of that, it has to be secretive. It has to be clandestine. But then when things are clandestine and kept away from robust oversight in government, sometimes they can go a little off the rails. And that's a reality, too. And, you know, look, I love the agency. I'm a big fan of it. It is staffed full of some of the greatest Americans you could ever meet. I wish someday, you know, I just wish everyone could know the people who I knew and who I know in the agency. These are phenomenal Americans who are willing to put their lives on the line on a near daily basis, many of them, and sacrifice a lot. One of you made reference earlier to, you know, the lifestyle of an agency officer. You're living, you know, your family doesn't know where you are. You're living in I used to say in an alternative dimension or in another dimension in which, you know, you're not engaging with people in the same way that normal people are. You're living in the shadows. You're trying to avoid being seen. When you are seen, you're trying to avoid being identified for who you really are. I mean, it's just a completely different way of living that separates you from everyone you love. So it's a big sacrifice. But it must be done, and it must be done that way. But naturally, Americans then, or any other people, could grow suspicious of, okay, well, what are these guys really doing? And I think that's natural. And in fact, I think it's healthy. I think that the agency is a very powerful organization. And it needs to have proper oversight by Congress. And that's better for the agency, and it's better for our country. But I also hope that Americans will give the people like me who have served and risked so much and sacrificed so much the benefit of the doubt, because, you know, we don't do what we do because it makes us rich, because it doesn't. You know, it ruins our familial relationships. It, you know, ruins friends, you know, friendly relationships. It impedes your ability to have a healthy love life. I mean, you give basically everything to do it, and at the same time, you're risking your life. And so, you know, with all that said, I do wish that Americans would understand that and give those who serve in that capacity the benefit of the doubt. Not just me, forget about me, but the others at least.
No, that certainly makes sense, and I'm glad that you kind of spoke out about that, because I think a lot of that gets lost. It's very easy to just sit there and you know, and point fingers to kind of just, you know, to be a backseat driver, so to speak. So I'm glad you brought that up. So let's kind of shift gears a little bit here and kind of go into the race. I mean, that's what you're doing. You're running for president.
Right.
What was it that when you first that made you decide that said, okay, you know what? Enough is enough. Something has to be done. I think I'm going to jump into this race. What was your thought process behind that?
Well, for really the whole year, I've been looking at the race and seeing the likely nominee on the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton, who, look, I just believe that the more news, the more we learn. I mean, even today, we're learning more about, you know, the percentage of people who got meetings with her when she was Secretary of State versus who donated to the Clinton Global Initiative. You know, you just sort of see this level of corruption that is actually what I used to see in the third world as an agency officer. And we just can't have leaders like that. We can't afford to have leaders like that in this country right now. Then on the Trump side, you know, this is a guy who's just wholly unqualified and poorly suited for the responsibilities he seeks. He's unstable. He doesn't know the first thing about what he would need to know about in order to serve effectively as the commander-in-chief and as our president. And he's dividing this country. He's pitting races against races and religions against religions and doing the sorts of things that our enemies want to do to us. Our enemies know that if they divide us, they'll weaken us in terms of our prosperity and our security and just our culture in general. It's a very clever thing that our enemies try to do to us, and it's not just made up. I mean, this is something that in the agency we understand and we know, and this is what Donald Trump is doing to us. So I think it's collective. It's all of these things. And more recently, it's also, it becomes clear all the time that Donald Trump is being either wittingly or unwittingly manipulated by Vladimir Putin. He has troubling ties to the Kremlin, as do many members of his team. It's unconscionable to me that we would allow someone like that and someone who's as divisive as he is and bigoted as he is, it's unconscionable to me that we would allow someone like that to have access to classified information, to be our commander-in-chief, and to be the leader of the free world. So all of that, I mean, it's a long answer, and I apologize for that, but all of these things collectively caused me to believe that someone needed to step forward to do this. I reached out to a group of people I knew were working on it a few weeks ago, hoping that they would, or more than about a month ago, I reached out now, in hopes that they would tell me, yes, we have somebody we're about to launch. Unfortunately, the answer was, no, we don't have anyone. And as those discussions progressed, they raised the idea of my running. And so I spent about a week and a half thinking about it and ultimately decided that I needed to do it myself if no one else would.
Well, the thing, and here's the big question is, you know, yep. you got in rather late.
Yeah.
So there's going to be some issues with getting on some of the state, getting on some of the ballots in states. You know, I think California was one, I think, that you guys had missed. But are you seeking, I think, I understand you're seeking legal action there to try and to fix that, or no?
Yeah, we're going to be pursuing a legal strategy in some states. I'm not exactly sure what direction we'll take on California. It sort of depends on some other things that come before that in the decision tree, if you will. But, you know, we certainly will be mounting legal challenges to certain states that have ballot requirements that are frankly intended to keep independent candidates off the ballot. You know, Texas is another one. You know, not all states have onerous requirements. I mean, many are reasonable, and so we're not going to be challenging those, but many are unreasonable, and those need to be challenged. You know, especially need to be challenged. Challenge, given the fact that 82% of Americans now, according to Gallup, believe that the country is on the wrong track. 42% of Americans consider themselves independent, while only 28% consider themselves Republican and 28% consider themselves Democratic. And then you have these two major party candidates that have historically high negative ratings. So all of these statistics together paint a picture of a situation in this country in which Americans are totally dissatisfied with the political, with what they're being offered in terms of leadership. And we need, I firmly believe, and I've been saying this, but I just have so much conviction around this, it is time for a new generation of leadership in America that isn't sort of bound by these old ideas that Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton are offering us. We need something new, someone that can unify us and move us forward. And so that's why I firmly believe that we've got to fight in certain states where they're trying to keep independents off the ballot. We've got to fight for that for the American people.
And okay, so to that effect, there are some people, and I want to see what your response to this is that your campaign is more about the ballot access issue than necessarily running for office. So that you know, the super PAC that is backing you, Stand Up Together. I think it was co-founded by Khalil Byrd and Chris Ashby, who worked for Americans Elect, which was an organization that was devoted to, you know, changing ballot access, making it easier for independent candidates to get on there. So is it a confluence of people that came in to kind of that had the same ideals? And so people are cynical. So they sit there and think, well, I think he may be doing this not so much because he really wants to be president, but more because there's some kind of thing going on where they're trying to, you know, increase ballot access. So what do you say to people who are kind of wondering about that?
Well, look, I would just say that it's all part of the same picture. Now, of course, I mean, I just have to say this to make it clear, because it really is a sticky legal thing. You know, we do not have contact with the super PAC. They act independently of the campaign. We can't coordinate with them, and we don't. I know Khalil Byrd, obviously. I know him from before. I've known him for several years. I know, you know, his efforts in the past. They're all part of the same thing. I mean, the idea is just that the country deserves a new generation of leadership that isn't bound by sort of the entrenched party positions of our two major parties right now, at least right now as they are right now with their two nominees. So yes, in order to do that, we need a ballot access strategy. And we're pursuing one that is multifaceted. It includes legal challenges. It includes petitioning on to ballots. It includes working with third parties, with other political parties, minor parties, who want to collaborate with us to get it to, so they essentially want to allow us to use their ballot lines to get us onto their state tickets. And then also we're doing what we need to do to be a write-in candidate in a write-in candidate in other states. So in some states you have to file for that, in others you don't. You know, so we're doing, our strategy is an all of the above strategy. We realize that it's late, and we are just fighting in every way possible to give as many Americans as we can an opportunity to vote for me, and I am offering myself humbly as what I believe is a better option for America, somebody who people can actually get behind and support, as opposed to just, you know, holding their noses and casting a vote for.
Well, and I think there's definitely something to be said for that, because so much of electoral politics in recent years has been tribal. It's been us versus them, and hold your nose, vote for somebody that you may detest because you hate the other person more. And so you're not really,
right,
you're not really voting affirmatively. I mean, and so your candidacy does provide for Republicans who are distressed at Donald Trump's candidacy and unable to reconcile themselves to voting for Hillary Clinton. It does give them something to vote for, I think that as they get to know you more, and as you get to more, get your message out there more, that will resonate with some people. But it's a slog. It's an uphill climb. I think you'd admit.
Yep.
I guess obviously success for you looks like winning the election, right?
Yeah, that's the goal. That's the goal for sure. Yeah.
So let's say that you don't win, but what would you like to achieve by your candidacy? What do you hope people get out of it, even if you do not get to the White House?
Well, before I answer that, let me go back to something you said earlier, that we're giving conservatives an option, a better option perhaps, or, you know, an option that is more in line with what they think and believe. What surprised me most, there have been several surprises in the past couple of weeks, but one of the things that has surprised me most is the extent to which Democrats are reaching out to us saying, hey, you know, we know we don't agree with all of your policy positions, but we trust you, and we like your tone, and I'm voting for you. You know, I mean, we were filming a, you know, web spot at the memorials in D.C. the other day, and this African-American student from Georgetown recognized me from across the way. That's happening more and more now. And he waved, and I waved at him, and he ran up to me, and he introduced himself, and he said, you know, hey, I'm a Democrat, and I'm not voting for Hillary Clinton. I'm going to vote for you. And he said, I just admire so much that you're standing up for what you believe in. And
really?
if my mom knew about this, she would kill me, but I'm going to vote for you. You know, and that's what's happening. I think it's not about me. It's about the fact that Americans, especially millennials, are just so ready to just shed the burdens of bigotry and top-down centralized government that restricts personal liberties, and that doesn't make any sense to them. They live in this world where they're empowered by technology more than any generation ever. And, you know, it's time to move on. They just want something better. They may not understand every issue yet because they've just sort of gotten involved in politics within the last few years. But they know that they don't trust Hillary Clinton, and they know that Donald Trump is horrible, and they're looking for something else. So I would just point that out, that it's not just Republicans that are considering us. It's really people from both sides of the aisle. As far as, you know, yes, we do want to win, and you know, yes, it's an uphill battle. We do see a couple of paths or a few paths to victory here. And we're pursuing those as hard as we can. But even as we do that, it's important for someone to be a voice of reason in this election. It's important for someone to be a voice for decency and tolerance, and a voice to defend the universal ideals enshrined in our Constitution that are important for all of us and really for all of humanity, just these ideas of equality and the pursuit of happiness. There needs to be someone in this race to make that case. And so as we work very hard to get on as many ballots as possible and to prevent either Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump from achieving a majority in the Electoral College, you know, we are doing what we can to help the American people remember what this country actually stands for and what actually makes it great.
Yeah, and you just brought up what I was just going to ask about. You know, one of the strategies that you're looking at is preventing either Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump from getting to 270 electoral votes, and that at that point it then goes to the House of Representatives. So let me ask you this: what kind of— okay, so let's just say that happens. Let's say you win enough states that neither of them get to 270. Now it goes to the House. I'm not even really sure the entire process of what it goes through. But what kind of case are you going to make? You're going to say, and you kind of just went through a whole litany of things, and that's great. But let's think about it more in a 50,000-foot view, where you're going to sit there and say, okay, here's the reason why you, as the House of Representatives, should choose me over Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. What would you kind of say some of the leaders in the House privately, if you were talking to them? What would be your conversation? What would that sound like?
Well, one of the first things is that you know, over the last several decades, for a variety of reasons, both through laws that have been passed early on in that period, and then as a result of some Supreme Court decisions, legislative power, much of it has been shifted from Congress to the executive branch, where you now have the executive branch passing major rules and regulations that have the force of law without any input from the people's elected representatives in Congress. The Constitution, and Article 1 of the Constitution, says very plainly that Congress, and only Congress, has the power to legislate. So one of the things members of Congress want most, especially Republicans, but I think this message can resonate with Democrats too, is that that power needs to come back to Congress. And I am all for that, because I think power needs to be closer to the people in Washington, and I believe more power needs to be pushed back to the states as our founders intended and as is necessary for a large pluralistic society to exist in harmony. I mean, these are the very important things that Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton have no idea about, I don't think. They don't think they understand these things. But that's one of the things I would do is be willing to sign a legislation. There's a good piece of legislation out there called the RAINS Act, which would return some of that power back to the legislative branch. I would do that. It needs to happen. It's a very important thing so that our people, our government is accountable to the people and so that the people feel like they're being heard by the government. So that's one thing I would do. But there are other reforms too. I would work with them to reform entitlements so that they're on a sustainable long-term path, so they're not, so that they're protected from insolvency. I would work with them to strengthen our armed services, which I know is a priority as well. I would work with them to reform taxes. Before I left the House, I was a part of the process to develop an agenda there that included a variety of economic and, tax reforms and other government reforms. I mean, I helped develop this, and Paul Ryan and his staff led this process with the input of all members of the House and leadership staff and other staff. And so, that's my background. I was part of that. I'm supportive of what they're doing. And I want to help them be successful, and I want to work with them. And I think it'll be clear to every member of the House, Democrats and Republicans, that I come from them. In many ways, I consider myself one of them. And so I hope that would give me an advantage in that setting.
Well, it's either going to do that or it's going to scare them off because you want them to actually do the job that they're like to do. So it could backfire, Evan. No, I'm just kidding. No, it's actually an interesting thing. A lot of people in conservative circles, you don't hear this too much because I think a lot of the general public doesn't pay attention as closely as some of us do. But yeah, there is that problem where the legislature themselves, the Congress themselves, they talk about, oh, the president needs to, stop with all this executive authority. Well, you guys they've given it away to the executive branch because they don't want to bear that responsibility because they do have to make tougher decisions. And even with things like the budget, for crying out loud, I mean, with these huge omnibus bills, everyone complains about them. Well, go back to regular order where there's 12 appropriations bills, I think what it is, and right. Then an actual budget is passed. So I think that's a great thing. Let's take a break here for a second. And when we were doing this, we asked people if they had any questions on our Facebook page, if they wanted to ask some questions. So if you're okay with that, we'll ask a few of those. First one here from Haley. She asks, how does Evan feel about warrantless domestic surveillance and protecting the Fourth Amendment through the war on terror?
Well, that's a great question. I'm glad to have the opportunity to answer that one. It hasn't actually come up much in the last couple of weeks. I come from the agency. It's where I started my career, and people often assume that, this guy's going to be all about all kinds of surveillance. But actually, this is the way I look at it. We are in a period of time where we have increasingly powerful technologies at our fingertips that we can use against threats against us and that we should use against threats against us. But at the same time, we've got these wonderful civil liberties that we absolutely must protect, including those enshrined in the Fourth Amendment. And we've got to find a balance there. And I think, when I was in the House as a staffer there, one of the things we did was pass legislation through the House that also then was signed into law that reformed part of the Patriot Act that ended the bulk collection of metadata. So that's information about, when you call somebody and how long the call lasts and, where you are and that sort of thing. That information was collected for all calls in the United States on a bulk basis without a warrant. And, I was uncomfortable with that. And so we moved legislation that ended it. And so now what happens is that the telephone companies hold on to that data. And then if the government wants access to it, it has to go get a warrant, the old-fashioned way. And then it can access that data and do what it needs to do. And so, I think that we're just learning how to deal with these powerful new technologies and how to balance the need to use them with our civil liberties, which absolutely must be protected. So I support I support protection of our papers, and I put that in quotations. You know, our private communications, our private, whether papers, whether they be soft or hard copies, they need to be protected. It's just a basic part of our civil liberties, and we can't allow that to be violated. The other thing I would say on that is it's really important. This underscores the importance of destroying terrorism and not allowing it to spread the way it has. It's metastasized under Obama's leadership. When we allow threats like ISIS to grow to this incredible level that it currently is, our civil liberties come under threat. And we need to make sure we understand that connection. That's why it is important that we destroy threats to liberty before they become so big that we're eavesdropping on each other and we're, you know, threatening people of a certain religion and saying we're going to give them cards and we're going to treat them differently and we're going to deprive people of their Second Amendment rights. And all of these things have happened in the past year as ISIS has become this terrible monster that it has become. And that's something I think that it's been lost on the Obama administration. I'm not sure they care, but this is why it's important to destroy these threats before they become as big as ISIS is. We have to do it in order to protect our civil liberties.
Interesting. Another question for you, Evan. Carla writes in the Georgia Senate Health and Human Services Committee hearing I sat through yesterday, an administrator at Georgia's second largest hospital said they consider patients who come in with Obamacare, quote unquote, metallic plans to be extremely underinsured. The deductibles are so high, these folks might as well not have insurance at all. What are Evan's plans for the healthcare sector, particularly ensuring that there are affordable insurance policies with deductibles low enough to be useful?
Well, that's a great question too. You know, we can do better than Obamacare. We just simply can. I mean, you have all of the insurance providers involved in the exchanges have either decreased their involvement or preparing to do. I think there's one that hasn't yet, but it's preparing to. I mean, it's just been a disaster. Now, I know that people who have been uninsured because of pre-existing conditions have now been through Obamacare, been able to be insured. And we need to ensure that those people do have access to affordable quality care. But we need to do it in a way that doesn't deprive everyone else in this country of access to affordable quality care. And so what I believe we should do is we should have a system that provides people advanceable, refundable tax credits through the year that support their purchases or their purchasing of private health insurance in the private market, and they can decide where they want to go for that. And that goes with them as they move around the country and as they go from job to job. That I think we need to go back to a free enterprise, a free market system. We also need to reform insurance laws to ensure that people with pre-existing conditions aren't denied coverage. We also need to reform insurance laws so that you can buy insurance no matter where you are. You can buy it from a provider anywhere in the United States. Right now it's broken down by state, which discourages competition. We need more competition, not less. I also believe that a part of a system that I would be in favor of would promote access, would broaden access to HSAs, and also broaden the approved ways that you can spend money in your HSA. Right now it's, you know, you can spend it on fee-for-service treatments, but you can't, for example, pay into an integrated system for a package of services. I think it should HSAs and the money in HSAs should be able to be used for that. But the theme here is the goal. I should start with the goal. The goal is to have, you know, affordable quality care that is accessible to all people. And I believe the means to it is by putting the patient first and empowering them with, you know, market making decisions where they have capital and they can choose where and how and when to spend it, which I think will increase competition among providers and insurers that will ultimately do something to bring down the cost of the cost of healthcare. Obamacare did nothing about that. It's just really a shame. So much work, the Democrats put so much work into it. It really didn't do much to decrease the cost of healthcare. So the system that I'm describing, I believe, would do that through competition.
Let me, there's another question from David asking about what is your view on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP. That's one issue where, believe it or not, we have the Republican candidate and the Democratic candidate on the same side of the issue. Both of them have been lashing out at free trade, where if you look deeply into it and the issue of trade and free trade, it's been very beneficial to the United States. But at the same time, you can kind of understand there may be some people who may have been displaced because of that. But it's not necessarily that it's greedy industry that's doing it. It's just a matter of the market kind of moving in that direction. So what is your view on TPP, free trade? And what do you say to somebody who might have been an unwitting victim of somebody who lost their job simply because something like that, the position that they had is not something that's viable anymore as we're moving into a new age?
Well, thank you for the question. I think we need to be far more sympathetic to people and realize and accept that there are people who really are struggling out there, who have lost their jobs, who have downward pressure on wages. I mean, the average manufacturing job hourly rate has only gone up, I think, in 10 years by $1 after you adjust it for inflation. It's just unacceptable. So look, there are people who really are suffering, and we need to be better about helping them. Germany has some interesting programs around their apprenticeship programs. So if you lose your job as a result of trade, then companies are incentivized to bring you on board and train you up in a new career. It ends up being a higher paying job on average, because that's what happens when we trade. We have higher paying jobs. But people need to be retrained, and they need to have a job immediately at the same time. So these apprenticeship programs, I think, are really something that we need to do more of in this country. Our programs are really ineffective at supporting people and helping them through the transitions. But having said all of that, I also believe that we've got to trade. And I think both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton are not being honest with the American people, frankly, about this. We simply have to trade. 95% of the world's consumers are outside our borders, and in many cases, our companies in the United States can't get to them because they're behind tariff walls, or if they do get to them, they're so disadvantaged that they can't really compete. These trade deals open up these markets to our companies. And so we've just got to do that. I mean, trade results in cheaper products coming to the United States and more of them, higher quality. And it also allows it brings higher paying jobs to the United States as well. And the other thing is that, our economy over the last 10 years adjusted in real terms, our GDP has only grown by an average of under 2% every year. Like, there's no way we can help people who are struggling in this economy if we're only growing it at less than 2%. We've got to be at about 3% or more in order to have an economy that offers robust opportunities to people of all economic levels and people graduating from school. So there are other things we need to do to get our economy cooking again. But trade is an important part of it, and I know it's an unpopular thing to say, but it's just the truth. But at the same time, I do believe that we've got to do more to look after the people and help the people who are struggling as our economy transitions in one way or another.
Excellent, excellent. Evan, completely changing gears here. This is a question that actually comes from me, and it may be a tad bit premature, but Let's talk fantasy VP picks here. Who do you have in the draft?
Well, I need to be careful about saying specific names, but who I'm looking for is somebody who understands on a very profound level what makes this country special, what makes this country great. Some of the things that I've discussed, I've mentioned earlier in this conversation. But, you know, I just feel like both of these candidates, the two major party candidates and the other ones as well, don't understand what has made this country the most powerful country on earth, the greatest experiment on freedom and equality the world has ever known. I just don't feel like they understand these things, and my VP pick will understand these things on a profound level. I also want somebody who is going to put the interests of the American people before their own, somebody whose interests are aligned with those of the American people, which means they will put the people first. You know, and then I look at, I'm candidly, and I haven't talked a lot about this, but you know, what the heck, I'll talk about it now. You know, I'm looking at, you know, people in Silicon Valley. I am looking also at people who are holding elected office already. I'm looking at different thought leaders too. But I think generally I'd like to have somebody who has spent time in the private sector or who's been in elected office and served the people well.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but you're a bachelor, right?
I am.
Okay, so you would automatically, if you win the election, you'd skyrocket to the top of every eligible bachelor list.
Well, I'm still bald, so you know you've got to discount that a little bit. I'm not that tall, and I'm bald, so you really do have to discount it a little bit.
But that would be an interesting thing. Would be I would imagine that probably make history in terms of presidential history. I don't think we've ever had a single president. Is that correct?
I mean, I would have said the same thing, but I've been informed by some people who took it upon themselves to do the research that long ago we have had a couple of bachelor presidents. Long forgotten guys.
Oh, okay. All right. So, all right. Ah, see that? Now you're not even gonna. Now you're gonna make history. That's too bad. But so, all right. And we're gonna wrap up here. This is the one question that for all the we love having this conversation with people. We don't. Our thing, Neil and I, is not to ask. You know, gotcha.
We try not to do gotchas. Really the only thing that we do that's kind of a gotcha question. And you mentioned that you're bald, and yeah. I wanted to say that you wear it well. And speaking of another man who wears his baldness well, Mr. Bruce Wayne, the star of the movie Die Hard. Now, I assume that you have seen this film.
Yeah, it's been a long time, so if you're going to quiz me on some line or plot twist, fail.
No. We're going to quiz you on one key element, one vital question, and that is this. Is Die Hard a Christmas movie?
Is Die Hard a Christmas movie? No.
Yeah! Finally!
Finally!
For truth and justice.
Neil gets some validation.
Thank you, Evan. You may have just earned my vote.
Well, thanks, I think.
All right. Well, Evan, tell everybody, you know, who's going to be listening to this, you know, where can they go to kind of get in touch with you, to get in touch with the campaign if they want to help out, just to kind of follow some news. Where can they reach you?
Yeah, please go to evanmcmullen.com you can volunteer there, you can contribute, everything helps. We've got a lot of people signing up to volunteer, but we need people across the country. We've got a lot of work to do. So if you want to get involved, volunteer online, contribute to us. Also, follow us on Twitter. I'm at Evan_McMullen, and you can get all kinds of updates all day long about what's going on.
All right. Well, Evan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate you taking the time.
Trail.
Yeah, we know you're busy.
Much appreciated.
You.
Thank you very much.
Good luck on the campaign trail, and good luck with everything. Evan McMullen, thank you very much. Good luck on the campaign trail, and hopefully at some point, you know, you like to come back.
I would love that. Yeah, I enjoyed this conversation, and you know, let's try to do it again. Really.
Terrific. Okay, Evan McMullen, ladies and gentlemen, and that's going to do it for this episode of The Fifth Estate. As always, if you like what you heard, go out there, subscribe to the podcast, leave us a rating. We appreciate that, and we'll talk to you next time. I'm Jay Caruso here for Neil Dewing. See you next time here on The Fifth Estate.
Bye-bye.